Oof, you look rough. Do
You look rough.
you look rough? Do you feel as bad as you look?
I do not feel great. So we had our annual
Oh,
Memorial Day cornhole tournament. Did you have fun yesterday?
I did,
Yeah.
yes.
So I don't drink, and for those, I mean, I do. I'll have a drink. I choose not to overindulge in alcohol. So, but when a kickoff to summer picnic rolls around, I'm hurting. I'm hurting today.
I believe it. Can we talk about how I'm taking your megaphone and lighting it on fire? I got
Nope.
Brenda's permission.
No one touches my megaphone. That's how else are people going to know what to do?
I was like, who gave him that? Who allowed
I
this?
bought it just for that. A lot of the problem is like I, as you know, our listeners probably don't. My eating habits these days are a little off. Like it, so I think my body's very confused right now. So it was like Thursday, pack of crackers. Friday, scrambled eggs on toast and something else. And then yesterday was like those lemon bites from Costco, 15 beers, hot dogs. Like, and it was I woke
Oh
up this
my
morning at like
God.
3 o'clock in the morning with the booze poos. Going just,
Oh.
oh God. So I'm excited to just listen to a crime. You do this episode. I want to just listen to a crime show and have some coffee.
Ed might take a nap, no worries.
Listening to Murder
Unscripted. What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 54 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
You are so sleepy, but hi.
You know what? The ring light, it's one of those, like the fridge light and the ring lights are a little bright, like in
Guys, Ed can't hang.
Hangovers when you are old, man, are just,
Oh my God.
it was a long weekend. Anyway, we are in a new month, so we get to kiss May's theme goodbye. Podcasters killed the radio star. That was fun, though.
It really was fun. I liked that theme. But wait, before we leave last month's theme, can we talk about our interview with the amazing women of People Are the Worst?
Such down to earth people.
Yes, like I felt very comfortable. Like I didn't feel like it was like a standard nervous kind of interview. Like it was very chill, like we were talking to our friends, which they are our new best friends. So, I mean,
Yeah, I'm not sure they know
stop
that,
it.
but
Well, listeners, if you haven't checked out People Are the Worst true crime podcast, please do. Rebecca and Rachel are just, like we just said, two of the kindest and funniest people I've ever met. You will not be disappointed.
They're
They
great.
are literally laugh out loud hilarious.
Absolutely, they are. Yeah.
All right, now we can move on to June, and we have a brand new theme. Ed, do you want to share it?
I do. June is, in my opinion, the unofficial kickoff to summer.
Yes.
So even though the weather's not in the 90s yet, it doesn't feel like summer out. It was like 60 and raining yesterday, but we are doing a theme called Hot Summer, Cold Cases, which means obviously we are going to be covering cold cases. And today, Melissa is going to be kicking us off with the first case of the block.
Yes, I am kicking this month off, and this first case is a doozy. It's a rough one.
Great.
We'll get into it, but before I start, do you have anything else you need to share?
Just the usual housekeeping stuff. So, other than if you could subscribe, like, we follow us. We're on every social media platform on the planet at this point. So,
Yeah.
Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Blue Sky, from what I understand, all under the handle Murder Unscripted. It really helps keep engagement up and drive what we do. So, we would appreciate it.
All right, now you're done. My
Now I'm
turn.
done. Yeah, now I'm done.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, well, now we are going to head to my favorite place.
Krispy Kreme, Target.
Oh, okay. We're going to my second favorite place. Krispy
Okay.
Kreme would be number one.
I could eat a donut
We are going to my favorite place, the 1990s,
right now. Oh,
specifically
Jesus.
I just want to be back there.
I thought it was like a place, like a physical place, like a store.
To me, it is a place. It's my mindset 24/7. Specifically, we're going to be in December of 1991, and our case today takes place in what seems to be like the serial killer hangout of the United States.
Washington
State. Which is also home to my brother and his wife, but way more importantly, sorry, Matthew and Noel, it's home to Edna.
No, it is home, yeah.
Edna's cousin, aka the light of my life, the wind beneath my wings.
Your Edna, extended family.
So before I start, I do want to mention my main source, which was a 48 Hours episode, which I'll name later in the episode. I do have a trigger warning for today's case. I'm covering the frustrating, depressing, and heartbreaking case of a 16-year-old. This was a tough case to research. It's one of those cases that kind of leaves you feeling like there is no hope for humanity. Because, like, a young person was murdered so quickly and so pointlessly. And it's, like, another example of, like, wrong place, wrong time, which I hate. I think it's so depressing to think that, like, it doesn't matter if you're a good person. It doesn't matter if you're a kid. It doesn't matter if you didn't do anything wrong. All that matters is being in like the wrong place at the wrong time.
You could literally be going to Krispy Kreme, driving to Krispy Kreme to get a donut. And like that is your sole intention and something bad happens. And it sucks because you don't want to tell people that you can't go anywhere or do anything because what kind of life is that? But it's just insane.
Oh, and we're going to throw in some serious failures in the justice system. And that's where we are with this case.
That's every single case.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, now that I've managed to drag you all down to my mental level, you're welcome. Glad to have some people here with me. I do have some kind of cool information about this case. So first of all, one of the detectives who worked on this case, Jim Doyon, he actually also worked on the Green River Task Force. Ooh. And he's the guy who filed the arrest paperwork on Gary Ridgway when they got him. Yeah.
That's cool.
And then another cool fact, this case, it ended up being cold for about 3 decades.
Wow.
It was ultimately solved by genetic genealogy, which is also what was used to identify the Golden State Killer.
That I remember vividly sitting in front of my computer screen and seeing that the image of his face, Joseph, what's his name? D'Angelo. Seeing that old man's face. And it was like, you could see that an awakening was happening. Like the next like big thing in forensics was happening right in front of your eyes. It was so freaking cool. And you knew that it was only a matter of time until like every month that passed, there was going to be another old white guy on the screen arrested for something he did 40 years ago.
I heard on another podcast, somebody was talking about how like they love the thought of these horrible killers sitting in their home thinking, shit, is today the day that my third cousin twice removed is going to upload her DNA to GenMatch and I'm going to get caught.
And they should, because of the devastation that they've caused victims and victims' families.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best thing they can. You want them looking over their shoulder every single day, being scared that today's the day. Fuck them.
I just like to think that, like, I'm an anxious person in general and generally feel sick. So I hope that they feel that like a billion
feel
times.
This. Yeah. 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 Feel hungover from a cornhole tournament. How about that? You ever think about that? The Jerks. Pain that I feel?
You are such an inspiration, Ed. Anyway.
I need a 5K in my name.
You need something. So the case I'm covering today is the first known instance where direct-to-consumer DNA test data was used to generate investigative leads for a cold case.
Super cool.
Like, it's the first case we'll get into it.
Okay.
So I'm going to real quickly attempt to explain the difference between genetic genealogy and familial DNA, because both of these are going to come up in our case. And I struggled to kind of understand the difference. So I think I got it. And I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible. So according to the 48 Hours episode, they said that genetic genealogy is, quote, the practice of using software to compare unknown DNA profiles to information from public DNA databases and searching family trees to identify suspects, end quote. So basically, the forensic genealogist takes the unknown DNA and compares it to DNA that had been uploaded by the public. So like if I did a 23andMe or one of those kind of things, I could choose to upload that data to like GEDmatch, mm-hmm. which would then be used in these type of cases. So mm-hmm. like we said a few minutes ago, if you're a murderer, you better hope your second cousin twice removed doesn't load their DNA in, because you're going to be in trouble.
Oh my gosh. The second this stuff came out, all those killers had to be like, uh-oh.
Oop.
Yeah. Oop.
Yep. Because you're like, your second cousin's an influencer and wants to like post her shit on Insta.
I'm 48% Italian. You're like, great. Well, you just got me convicted of 48 murders. So thanks.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So familial DNA, I think, is simpler to understand. This is when investigators run DNA through their system, CODIS, and it compares the DNA to other felons and criminals whose DNA is already in the system. So this is not a public database. Only investigators have access. And this is more like the DNA would be a partial match to a parent, a child, a sibling.
Right.
And this may be an unpopular opinion, but this seems like a freaking fantastic way to catch more murderers and like sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
However, for whatever stupid reason, not all states allow this, which I think is bullshit. We're going to get into it later, but there's states who specifically ban it.
It's about protecting people's privacy. It's a bigger...
Prisoners who murdered...
I know.
...or committed a sexual offense, they get nothing.
I know. I agree. They make these blanket policies to protect everyone, and then when situations like this come up, they're like, oh, maybe it's not as perfect as it seems on paper.
That's... Yeah. There's a lot of that going on in this episode. So basically, if criminal Bob Smith commits a crime and leaves his DNA behind, authorities can run this DNA through CODIS. They either get a match, because Bob Smith is already in the system, or, depending on the state, they could run the DNA again and look for a partial match. And then it could come back and be like, oh, this is Bob Smith's parent, child, sibling, etc. It's so confusing, but it's so cool. So to the people that fully understand it, mad props. So much applause.
Totally. And I think what's really cool about genetic genealogy is it's so old school. Like we talk about how technologically big this was for the forensic community, but at the same time, it's such basic stuff. It's legwork. It's little old ladies in a library running down property deeds, marriage records, death mm-hmm. records. So the familial DNA can sometimes tie into genetic genealogy. Like one leads to the other. And then it's just about going, I'm picturing all these little old biddies with a microfiche in the library. Like that's what it is though. Sometimes detectives will go to a library and track down old records.
I just think that's so cool. I love it. And I'm going to talk about actually like the woman who kind of figured it all out first. So I'm going to get to her later in the episode. So as I mentioned, today's case takes place in Federal Way, Washington, which is about 25-30 minutes south of Seattle, like a direct straight line down, it looks like on the map. So in the 48 Hours episode, they show aerial shots of this little city, and it is gorgeous. It's like this little city tucked in between Puget Sound and these beautiful snow-capped mountains.
Wow.
It's picturesque.
Full of piss.
It's full of piss. It is absolutely picturesque. I still didn't say it right, did I?
That works. We know what you mean.
In the early 90s, when our case takes place, Federal Way had roughly 67,500 residents. So not a huge city, but definitely not like a little blip on the map. And the people in the city had been pretty lucky to live in a relatively safe little bubble. So they certainly didn't expect what would happen just 11 days before Christmas of 1991. It would rock this community to its core, and sadly, from even just going through research, like I think it continues to kind of leave a dark cloud over the city. I read a 2002 article, it was in the Tacoma News Tribune, and the federal mayor, like at the time of the murders, I believe, Bob Steed, he said about Sarah's murder, that's my victim, quote, "It was an awakening. We thought we were insulated from those kind of things," end quote.
I just got back from a shoot that was like this. It was like, it just doesn't happen there until it does. And then you're like, what do we do? the city I was talking about was Delphi, and I should have mentioned that because
we could talk about it.
I know. I mean, everybody on the planet who likes true crime knows about Delphi. Being in Delphi, Indiana, those people will never, ever, 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 ever be the same. No. It's because this little town was known for nothing. I mean, you go there, there's nothing to do. It's a mm-hmm. typical Midwest town, very small. And then something like this happens and all of a sudden national world media is flooding to your town, sticking microphones in your faces and stuff. And now that's all Delphi is known for and will ever be known for.
It's true. Like, unless like the next Taylor Swift is born there, no one's ever going to know it for anything else.
Exactly.
All right. So it's Saturday, December 14th, 1991. And it's sometime between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. And 13-year-old Drew Miller and his friend, it was another 13-year-old boy who has never been named publicly, they're just walking around town looking for like a good spot to skateboard. And Drew was on the 48 Hours episode, and he explained that the boys, like, they decided to cut through the grounds of the local high school, Federal Way High School. As Drew and his friend make their way through the fields, they're like just joking around, being teenage boys, jumping in frozen puddles just to hear the ice break like glass. He specifically talks about that, which I was like, that's such a goofy teenage boy.
It really is a guy thing.
So they're just, you know, being kids when out of nowhere, a man like pops up from this
areola.
A man pops up from an areola.
With his areolas. Hello.
Yes.
Put your nipple away.
Away, pervert. And this guy's nipples were probably real dirty. He's dirty looking.
And dark.
Oh, stop.
Like pepperonis.
Stop. Okay, moving on. When out of nowhere, a man pops up from this area of overgrown like bushes and grass, and he just stares at the boys. And the boys are surprised and caught off guard, and as they make eye contact with this man, they both feel this chill, and it has nothing to do with the cold Pacific Northwest winter.
Wow.
So this man they see, he's young, like mid-20s-ish, okay. And he's got dirty blonde hair cut into a Joe Dirt mullet that would make Billy Ray Cyrus's achy breaky heart pitter-patter just a little faster. He'd be all over this mullet.
I can picture him.
But there is something very sinister about this guy. Maybe like it's his creepy Columbine killer-esque trench coat.
He's got a trench coat on?
He's wearing a trench coat, yes.
Wow.
Which just makes you creepy.
Yeah.
Maybe it's his like acne-ridden, like ruddy complexion. Or maybe it's his eyes, which seem to emit something inhuman. Drew Miller would later go on to explain that when he looked into the man's eyes, he could just sense pure evil. So this creeper man, who also kind of appears a little bit startled, like that the boys saw him, he proceeds to turn away and quickly walks ahead of the boys. And the kids relax a little bit and like they try to shake off the odd encounter. But as they walk a little bit further ahead, they see something in the grass right where the strange man was standing. It's a young woman lying in the overgrown grass and bushes, completely still.
Oh my God.
And as the horror of what they're seeing begins to like unravel in their brains, the boys look up toward the man who's still ahead of them, but now he's facing them again, just like staring at them intently.
That's terrifying.
It's so scary. So they're just kind of caught in like this stare off for a minute. And then the man turns away and the frightened teenagers run as fast as they can back to their homes where they tell their parents what happened and like what they saw. So one of the boys' parents calls 911 while the other one runs toward the school, probably hoping that the boys are wrong. Like, there's no way these two 13-year-old kids found a body, right? By the time the parent gets to the school, the police are already on site. So Drew Miller and his friend were right. There on the school grounds, just feet away from the parking lot and the building, was the body of a young woman. The girl was partially clothed in her blue and white drill team uniform with hot curlers still in her hair. When police arrived on the scene, they were immediately taken aback by the sheer ruthlessness and cruelty of this attack. Our victim had obviously fought for her life, and as they began investigating the scene, they first noticed how the victim had been like partially undressed. She's still wearing her drill team uniform skirt,
Okay.
But her jacket, her underwear, and her bra were lying next to her body, and her drill team uniform sweater had been pulled up.
Clear signs of a sexual assault.
Well, we'll get there, because she wasn't totally sexually assaulted.
Okay.
So while they couldn't be 100% positive until confirmed during the autopsy, authorities were pretty sure the victim had been strangled with her own nylon pantyhose because they were still tied tightly around her neck.
Got it.
So investigators, like you just said, they originally believed the victim had been raped, but we will later find out that her disgusting pig of a killer had ejaculated on her clothing during an attempted rape.
We just talked about that with Debbie Dykus, too. It was like it looked like a sexual assault when they got there. It turned out to be something, maybe a botched sexual assault.
So the investigators notice the name Sarah embroidered on the victim's blue and white drill team uniform, like in the corner of the sweater.
Mm-hmm.
A few detectives are on the 48 Hours episode, and Detective Scott Strathy, he was one of the first ones on the scene, and he worked the case, and he, like, talks about how difficult this crime scene was. Like, even to the most seasoned officers, he says, quote, "Even for experienced investigators, this scene was really hard to deal with. Just the innocent nature of this young woman in her school drill team uniform with hot curlers still in her hair. This was just pure, unadulterated evil," end quote.
Yeah, because a lot of times these investigators will have daughters, they'll have nieces. Mm-hmm. It hits harder because you could see your own family member in that situation.
100%. So, parked just about 100 yards or 300 feet away from the body was Sarah's car. And it didn't take authorities long to tentatively identify the victim as 16-year-old honor student Sarah Yarborough. She was a bright, bubbly, and beautiful 11th grade student at Federal Way High School. Before we talk more about Sarah, I do just want to finish going over the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, in Sarah's vehicle, police didn't see any signs of a struggle. Like, her bag or purse, it's sitting on the front seat. There's a jug of her orange juice still sitting in the passenger seat, like neither had been disturbed.
Hmm.
So investigators had to figure out how Sarah had gotten from her car to where her body was found.
Right.
And as they begin talking to Sarah's friends and family, they quickly realize that while Sarah was incredibly smart and had such a good head on her shoulders, she was also like such a kind-hearted human that if she thought someone was in trouble or needed help, like she would have been the first one to go and help them.
That could explain it. Yeah.
So like their kind of working theory leads them to believe that Sarah had probably been lured to the area where she was found.
Or the other theory would be someone she knew who was riding in the car with her and said, "Hey, let's go out and take a walk."
Oh, that's true.
Something to consider.
Except there was stuff on the passenger seat. So I feel like if someone was with her, it would have been the back seat.
They would have moved it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Sarah Louise Yarborough was born on Thursday, June 12th, 1975. She was the first of three children born to Thomas and Laura Yarborough. And they would eventually go on to have two more kids, two boys, Micah and Andrew. Sarah loved being a big sister to these boys. And this makes me laugh. In one of the articles I read, they talked about how, like, if her little brothers didn't know what, like, a bad word meant, they could always count on Sarah to fill them in.
That's amazing.
That, like, made me smile. That's such, like, a sibling thing. Like,
yeah, right.
Oh, what does blah, blah, blah mean? And, like, no one tells you.
Come here, I'll tell you.
Exactly. So, as she grew up, Sarah was known as her mother's mini-me. Like, she looked and sounded just like her mom. And the mother-daughter duo seemed really, really close. When people looked at Sarah, and I could show you a picture, and I know what the first thing you're going to notice is her hair. She had these absolutely gorgeous, fiery red curls, so reminiscent of Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, the morning after she meets Richard Gere's character, and her beautiful red curls are big and natural and wild, but they're perfect.
Oh my God, I just looked up a picture. It's unique.
Yes.
Like really unique.
She's beautiful.
She stood out. Yeah, totally.
And like, the second thing people noticed about Sarah was her smile. And again, very reminiscent of Julia Roberts. Like,
yeah,
Sarah had this most beautiful smile, and her whole face lit up. her eyes lit up, these big, beautiful blue eyes. And of course, that looks great with red hair. So
oh, sure. Yeah, right.
One of her teachers talked about her, quote, megawatt smile, end quote, which I thought was so sweet.
I've heard you use that expression before. I'd never heard that, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard that. Yeah, like, oh, she has megawatt smile.
Yeah, never. I'm way out of touch, though.
That's true. Well, Sarah was just as beautiful inside as she was on the outside. Several of her friends are on the 48 Hours episode, and I'll talk about them in more detail later, but they talked about how she was so creative, artistic, imaginative, and she could be feisty. She had her moments.
Most redheads do.
Yeah, right? Fiery red hair to match like her feisty personality.
Yeah.
So she was an honor student. She was on the drill team, and she had really big plans for her future. Her family and friends talk about how Sarah loved to travel, and she had plans to attend college outside of Washington State. And she would tell her friends and family she either wanted to be a museum curator or an engineer like her dad was.
Wow. That's different.
They're both such cool, like, I would love to be a museum curator. That would be so fun.
I can be pretty peaceful.
Yes, agreed. So let's talk about the day leading up to Sarah's death. It's Friday, December 13th. And after they finished school that day, Sarah and a girlfriend of hers, Shannon, who's on the 48 Hours episode. The girls were super excited because they had a sleepover that was planned for later that night. And this sleepover was like especially exciting because the girls were going to be home alone.
Oh, wow.
So one of Sarah's younger brothers had a soccer tournament in Ocean Shores, Washington, which was about 2 hours away. So Sarah's parents and her other brother were going to be away for, I don't know if it was the whole weekend or just Friday night, but they would be away. And to be clear, this was not a usual occurrence. This was the first time that Sarah had stayed home alone like this by herself. First time ever. So her mom, Laura, is on the 48 Hours episode, and she talks about how she was understandably hesitant to leave Sarah home alone that weekend, but you know, Sarah kind of teased her and for being a worried mom. And she just begged her. She's like, I'll be fine. So, and not only that, but she had already planned her whole weekend out. You know, teenagers, they got shifted.
Of course.
So she had like a big drill team event on Saturday morning and she didn't want to miss it. So her parents reluctantly agreed that Sarah could stay home by herself. After Sarah and her friend Shannon finished school that cold December Friday, they first ran some errands, including a stop at the local grocery store to pick up snacks for their sleepover, obviously.
Duh, that's 101.
I know, right? They grabbed some fast food, and then later that night, the girls went to a basketball game at their high school. In the 48 Hours episode, the friend who slept over is interviewed, and she talks about how Sarah really liked this boy, and like they went to the game like hoping he would be there. And I think any girl or woman listening to this can totally relate to this. Like, you think your crush is going to be somewhere, so you and your friends carefully pick out outfits and probably put on way too much makeup. And as this is the 90s, I'm guessing there was body glitter involved.
Oh, man, probably. Yeah. And it's funny. I remember being that age and those feelings, the first feelings of like love and lust. And it you did things that your body, you were like, what are these strange feelings? And you would like try to weasel your way into your crush's life in these little like awkward teenage ways.
Like, oh, yeah, I just happened to show up wearing.
Oh, my God. Look, yeah. Like, oh, hey.
And like what I was just about to say is like the whole time, like you have this excited but like nervous pit in your stomach about seeing your crush.
Of course.
Unfortunately, though, the boy Sarah liked ended up not going to the game that night. So like, of course, Sarah's bummed, but she wasn't going to let that drag her down. You know, she had the sleepover. So
she still has a fun night. Yeah,
exactly. She's with her friends. Like, that's great. So the girls went back to Sarah's house for the sleepover, ate their snacks, watched movies, and ultimately they fell asleep in the living room. The next morning, Saturday, December 14th, Sarah woke up in a panic. In all the fun of the sleepover, she had forgotten to set an alarm, and she was super worried she was going to be late for her drill team event that day. And like, whatever this event was, because I saw differing accounts, but it required the team to travel by bus to get there. So like you had to be at school at a certain time or the bus was going to leave without you.
Buses leave and be on it.
Right. So she's like running around trying to get dressed in her uniform, doing her hair. That's why she had the hot curlers in her hair still. So she heads towards school and she's got, you know, her big bottle of orange juice in her passenger seat.
Yeah.
So when she gets there, she reaches the parking lot and she realized she actually wasn't running late. She was super early.
Oh.
And I don't know the exact times, but like whatever time she thought they were supposed to meet was actually an hour later. So let's just say they were supposed to meet at 9. She thought it was 8. So she arrived at like 8:15 thinking, yeah, and I'm thought 15 she was late. But she's actually 45 minutes early.
Well, okay.
So she decides to just kill time waiting in her car. No big. And what happens next is really known only to Sarah and the monster who killed her. But we do know what, you know, Drew Miller and his friend found. And we do know that once like her drill team teammates started arriving, it did not take them long to be like, where the heck is Sarah?
Where's Sarah? Right.
Right. And of course, no one has cell phones. So like they can't just text her and be like, where are you at? Mm-hmm. YWD. WYD. Right. I don't know. Right.
It's not YWD.
Where are you at? Whatever.
Yeah.
YWA.
Yes.
So like, you know, they called her house phone, but there's no answer. There isn't much they can do. And at this point, authorities start arriving because, you know, Drew Miller and his friend and one of the parents get back to the school. So There's a lot going on. And police very quickly begin interviewing Drew Miller and his friend. And these boys are able to give really detailed descriptions of the creeper man that they had seen in that area this morning. And I just want to say, Drew Miller, of course, he's an adult at the point of the 48 hours episode, but it is abundantly clear that finding her body has stuck with him. At one point, the interviewer asks about him finding Sarah's body, and he says, quote, it was horrible, absolutely horrible. The way that he left her body, she clearly fought for her life, end quote.
That has to be ingrained. And I know from talking to people who have found bodies before, it's hard to talk about even because they're nightmares that don't go away. It's a picture of the worst thing you can imagine in your head, and it just stays there because you can't forget it.
We're 30 plus years later, but it's like he can see it perfectly. So authorities also come across another witness who had seen the attack on Sarah and was able to give a pretty good description of the man. This part pisses me off, but apparently this witness was some dude jogging at the time of the assault. Mm-hmm. He came across Sarah being attacked, but this jogger assumed the couple were engaging in a consensual sexual act, so he just jogged away.
So if you got bullshit. You got one bullshit is right. So you got one girl in a drill team outfit and another guy in a trench coat with him. Like,
I just think he didn't want to get involved.
That could be too. But damn, dude,
like, come on,
live with that now.
Exactly. I mean, like, he did assist police when they went to make a sketch, so that's great. But I will put it out there that one source said the man had just recently moved to the United States. So. Okay. Sure. Maybe he didn't know what to do. Maybe he was too scared to say anything.
Yeah.
Bullshit, whatever. Let's move on. So originally, it seems like authorities thought this was going to be solved pretty quickly. They had witnesses. They had a composite sketch. They had evidence. They were very confident. But it did not go that way. Weeks turned to months, and those months turned to years, and still, no one was held accountable for Sarah's brutal murder. And I want to be very clear, this was not for lack of trying. Sarah's grandfather said publicly that he felt the authorities did everything they could. Like, well, everything. That's good.
Because yeah. A lot of times the families will shit on the cops because they think nothing's going on. Even though behind the scenes there's a lot of stuff going on, that stuff can't be made public all the time. So a good detective will keep the family in the loop. They won't give them the details because you don't want that stuff getting leaked. But what they can do is say, we have something in the works, or this, we're doing A, B, and C. So don't worry. Like, just staying in communication with them goes such a long way.
It's true. So we're going to fast forward a little bit. On June 12th, 1993, Sarah's mother looked on as her daughter's classmates and friends walked across the stage to receive their high school diploma. Adding to this day was the fact that this graduation ceremony fell on what would have been Sarah's 18th birthday.
Oh, shut up.
I know.
Freaking awful. Just keep adding, keep piling on.
pile it on. And in the 48 hours episode, one of Sarah's friends says something along the lines of, I don't know where Laura found the strength to be there for us.
Wow. That's powerful.
This was part of the research that I struggled to get through. Like, her poor mother, it is so clear from the moment she found out Sarah was gone, her heart just shattered into 8 bajillion pieces.
Yeah, I'll bet.
In one article, she talked about how one day she realized she couldn't hear Sarah's voice anymore.
They say time heals all wounds, but at a certain point, time also, like, takes away those memories. If it's death, if it's a breakup, if it's something, like, those voices that you are used to hearing every day become fainter and fainter.
I remember that happening to me as a kid after my dad died. Like, one day, I was doing fine. Hold on. One day, I think I was about 8, just being like, oh my God, what did his voice sound like? What did he smell like?
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I know it's tough. I didn't mean to.
No, it is hard. And this case really got to me.
I think it's a good thing, though. Like, that, I know from knowing you, like, you kind of bottle your feelings up. So mm-hmm. I know this sucks, but I think it's good to talk about.
Yeah. So yeah, when Sarah's mom said that, I was like, I remember that feeling and it's so hard. But prior to the graduation ceremony, I would say maybe like a couple weeks before, they unveiled this really awesome memorial for Sarah. It was a bench at the high school. And it had been designed with the help of a man named William Fuller. And he was a neighbor of, like, the Yarborough family, and, like, his daughter went to school with Sarah. So he was really instrumental in, like, getting this memorial made, and I think he helped design it. So he and Sarah's little brother unveiled the bench together.
That had to be hard for them, but what a great mm-hmm. way to commemorate. I wonder if it's still there. I'm sure it is.
It is, yes. So the memorial bench had the phrase Carpe Diem engraved on it, because that was Sarah's motto. Yes. And the bench also had several items of, like, that were very important to Sarah. And these items were encased in bronze. Oh. So it was her backpack. It was some books. Apparently, wow. She really loved reading Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
And of course, this part really got me. Also in bronze was a statue of her dog, Gibby.
It really, to me, it shows how much of an impact on people's lives that Sarah made, you know, and I'm sure that yep. there's this, like, survivor's guilt that was going on.
Oh, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the memorial has really become a place that, like, her friends still go and visit. And one thing that really struck me on the 48 Hours episode was so many of her friends were on the show, like, talking about what a beautiful person she was. And it felt so powerful because, like, these are grown women who lost a friend 30 some years ago. But she made such an impact.
When I went out to Nixon, Missouri, it was the Jackie Johns case. I don't think I have to hide any of this anymore. So Bodies in the Water, Jackie Johns, she was a prom queen, basically, back in the 80s, and we interviewed her friends. And to know, these were friends that used to be kind of like in a little, like, conservative box, and Jackie Johns brought that out in them. So, like, when Jackie was taken away, the memories of what Jackie did for them, they still hold on to them, and they remember, like, just the way that Jackie brought out the best in them. And they still go to her cemetery. They still put her favorite flowers on her grave. They still do things in honor of Jackie. So that initial pain does go away. And it's awesome that they have something like this. I know it's sad in the moment when we're talking about it, but it's awesome that all these years later, they have a place to go with all these amazing things to just say, this is my friend. This was her. Mm-hmm. Here's the stuff in bronze. Here's a bench. Like, just seeing that stuff brings you back. And it connects you to that person again.
Well, and you just mentioned survivor's guilt. These women clearly struggled, and they talk about the survivor's guilt. And they're like, why am I filling out college applications and Sarah's not?
you can't be in control of everything that happens in this world, especially maniacs who are right. acting completely just off the rails, no rhyme, no reason. Like, you have to find the power and the strength to move on in some way, or you're going to bring yourself down, and your lost friend would not want that.
Yeah. Well, by January of 1995, detectives had chased down and worked through about 4,000 leads.
Wow.
They had interviewed and taken either like blood or saliva samples from 39 different men. Some of these guys took polygraphs, but.
Yeah, they had to start working through everybody. I mean, if it's a small town like this, any male in that town is now a suspect.
They just worked so hard. I really think that they did. But we are going to have to fast forward because sadly, there's not much movement in the case until 2011. 20 wow. years after her murder. And this is the part of the episode I'm so excited for.
Good. Let's get past the sad. Let's get to some happy stuff.
Yes. I get to introduce you to the new love of my life. I realize I have a new one every week, but this
yeah,
lady,
you're a helicopter.
I get around with loves of my life. Well, Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick, this woman is an absolute angel. I'm not even totally convinced she's real because she's just like that amazing.
Wow.
She is very real and very incredible. So Dr. Fitzpatrick is a forensic scientist and a genealogist, but she also has her PhD in, you know, nuclear physics.
Oh my God.
From Duke University. Oh.
Mine was like Frisbee from Kutztown University.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh. And she's worked for NASA and the U.S. Department of Defense. And if we were writing an infomercial about Dr. Fitzpatrick, this is the part where we would be like, but wait, there's more.
Oh.
She founded the organization known as Identifiers. And this group would use the This group would use Y chromosomal testing in order to identify male murderers. And she is the co-founder of the DNA Doe Project.
Oh, no way. It's a nonprofit that basically uses investigative genetic genealogy to help law enforcement. It's basically and medical examiners to identify unclaimed human remains. The Jane Does, Jane John Does.
And like what I'm telling you is just like one billionth of all the amazing things she has accomplished. But one more super cool thing that she has done, she helped identify the remains of a 19-month-old baby. He had died in this little accident. I don't know if you've heard of it. The Titanic.
No, oh, yeah, I think I've heard bits and pieces.
So love her. In 2011, King County Police Department, they got in touch with Colleen Fitzpatrick and they asked her to kind of look into Sarah's case using genetic genealogy. And they were a little apprehensive, but Colleen basically was like, just let me try. What's the harm in trying? So she took on Sarah's case and she began to painstakingly use genetic genealogy to map out an entire family tree that would eventually lead to our killer.
That's the stuff I was talking about earlier, like the old school, like you really just start, you literally you start drawing it out. You start making connections and you draw it out. It's so cool because of how simplistic it is. It's the most complex thing in the world done simplistically.
It's so freaking cool.
Yeah.
So Colleen was able to figure out that Sarah's killer was related to someone with the name Robert Fuller. So Colleen takes this name, specifically the last name of Fuller, to investigators. And if you've been paying attention.
He's the neighbor, the guy with the bench.
Yes.
Damn.
Investigators are shook. Wow. It's the same last name. The guy whose daughter went to school with Sarah. Yeah. The man who was so instrumental in designing this bench.
That is nuts. Please tell me he did not do it. Because that, cue the crow,
dun,
right?
Done. He did not do it. He did not do it.
Oh, shit. No.
So when Sarah's family finds out about this, they're like, absolutely not. They were adamant that William could not possibly be Sarah's killer. And they were right. He did not do it.
Okay. Whew.
first of all, he didn't really match the sketch that the boys had given to police, you know? And second of all, he was much older than what the witnesses had described. Like, I think when our killer was like in his 20s, this guy was like 40 something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So William was fully cooperative with police. He's like, take whatever you need. Here's my DNA. Not a match. But our girl Colleen was not deterred. Back to the drawing board she went. And over the next few years, technology advanced. And then in 2018 came quite possibly the biggest news in true crime history.
Mm-hmm.
They had arrested the infamous monster, the Golden State Killer.
And the floodgates opened from there.
Yes. So this just led to more advancements. And finally, in 2019, almost 30 freaking years after Sarah's murder, Colleen and her entourage hit the jackpot.
Excellent.
They had two suspects. Two men, two brothers, who did actually end up being distant cousins of William Fuller, but like so distant that neither knew the other existed.
Yeah, just random. Wow.
Yeah. So these brothers were Edward Nicholas and Patrick Nicholas. So we're going to talk about these garbage bag humans. In the words of Rachel and Rebecca, these two brothers are the worst. So Edward, who I believe was the older of the two, he was a sex offender. And because of this, his DNA was in CODIS. Remember, the DNA from Sarah's case was not in CODIS.
Correct.
So that rules out pervert brother number one.
Yep, that would have hit immediately. As soon as, like, it would have returned an instant match.
So that leaves us with pervert shitbag number two, Patrick Leon Nicholas. Their parents must be so proud. What does their Christmas card say?
It was like that guy from Cory Parker who his brother stabbed somebody 99 times.
Yes, exactly.
He's like, I think that's a life path that I'd like to take.
What a bunch of assholes. So before we get to him, though, I want to go back to the beginning where we briefly discussed familial DNA testing. Patrick Nicholas's DNA was never run in CODIS for a partial match because Washington State, the state that loves to pretend they are so progressive.
It's crazy because they're the state with all these freaking maniacs running around in the woods, killing people for decades on end.
California has it. Colorado has it. Wisconsin, Florida. There are currently 16 states that allow familial DNA testing. Our home state of Pennsylvania is not one of them, so I'm very disappointed in us. Both Maryland and Washington, D.C. have specifically banned familial DNA testing. They're upset that it would infringe on the prisoner's rights.
You know who really has no rights? The victim. Not only don't they have rights, they didn't have a say in whether they lived or died.
Right. Like, I just don't understand how anyone can be like, but the prisoner.
Yeah. Oh.
So basically, this means Patrick Nicholas could have been apprehended decades ago. Her family could have had answers decades ago.
It's so frustrating.
Yes, that's the first injustice in this completely ridiculous nonsense, but it gets so much worse, so hold tight. So they finally have a real true suspect, Patrick Nicholas, who at this point is in his mid-ish 50s. Back in 1991, when Sarah was murdered, Patrick Nicholas was 27 years old at the time. And not only did he look strikingly similar to the composite sketch, but also he had been living in a neighboring town. And like wherever he was working at the time, he took the bus there. And can you guess where his bus route went?
I would guess near the high school.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
Yes. So in 2019, Patrick had been working in an auto parts store. He was divorced and lived alone. No friends, and I don't know if he kept in touch with his degenerate brother. But also at this time, the home he was living in was a complete dump. No electricity, just garbage and boxes.
Not surprised.
What else in this disgusting house?
Yeah, he's garbage, so it makes sense.
So garbage. And tons of, like, pornography everywhere and, like, bad porno, like, disgusting things, like, we're open to a lot around here.
Yeah, I was going to say, where's that line? Because I don't think I found it yet.
Oof, this line is oof. So At this point, it's September 2019, and police need Patrick's DNA to compare to the DNA left on Sarah's clothing. So they decide to surveil him, and one day he's at this laundromat, and while waiting for his clothes, he goes outside and smokes a few cigarettes.
Hmm.
And in the ultimate sin for Washingtonians, he littered.
Oh, God forbid. We don't need DNA legislation, but don't you dare throw a cigarette on the ground.
Well, not only did this trash bag throw his cigarettes on the ground, but he also had a napkin in his pocket that he threw on the ground as well.
Oh, of course. Why not at that point?
Of course. So, you know, investigators are like holding their breaths, waiting for Patrick to go inside. This reminds me of the case where they got the spit out of the puddle.
Yeah, where he's just waiting for him to spit.
Yes. So when Patrick goes inside, they jump on this. They grab the discarded cigarettes and the napkin. And I imagine they book it to the forensic lab.
Probably. Yeah.
And when the DNA is tested, it's a perfect match to the DNA of Sarah Yarborough's killer.
Amazing.
And before you ask why the last names didn't match, like Fuller and Nicholas, It turns out Patrick's grandfather had been adopted.
The complexity of this entire thing that we were just talking about, that's an example. Like, it's really basic stuff, like tracing family lineages. But when you get into remarriages, adoptions, fosters, that really puts a wrench into the whole process, because now you have to go down that rabbit hole just to tie that person back to the family to get them to fall in line with where your investigation's going.
It's true. So, like, that's like one of those weird things. And, you know, so the last name that Patrick had, which was Nicholas, that was the last name, I guess, of like the adoptive parents of his grandfather.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So anyway, police bring Patrick in and they ask him, you know, like, why do you think you're here? And Patrick says he doesn't know. There's some more questioning before Patrick asks, quote, what am I being charged for? The detective responds, quote, what we're investigating is the death of a young girl. Her name is Sarah Yarborough. End quote. Patrick chillingly responds, quote, what year? End quote.
Oh, shit. So he's like, this is not a one-time thing.
Yeah, exactly. So this, of course, makes the detectives even more suspicious. Like, that's a weird thing to say. Someone tells you you're being investigated for a murder, and instead of saying, no, I didn't do it, you say, oh, what year?
Yeah, wow.
Shortly after this, Patrick is done talking, asked for a lawyer. In the meantime, detectives are like really digging into Patrick's past because, you know, his DNA wasn't in CODIS, but like, how could he not have committed other crimes?
And seriously.
Soon they discover the horrific crimes that Patrick had already committed and served time for.
So why wasn't his DNA?
Legal loopholes.
God.
His DNA was never taken and therefore never uploaded into CODIS.
I thought, when a felony occurs, your DNA gets taken. Like, no, even in 91. No question.
I thought so too, but he managed to escape all of that. Wow. So by the time he was 19 years old, he had already been convicted and spent time in prison for raping two women.
God damn, what a sick bastard.
It doesn't stop there, because just a few months after he was released from prison, he attempted to rape 19-year-old Ann Crony. And Anne is on the 48 Hours episode, and she refers to herself as the one who got away.
Wow. Lucky.
Yes, so lucky. So back in June of 83 in Richmond, Washington, which is less than a decade before Sarah's murder, Anne had been sitting on the banks of the Columbia River enjoying her summer day when a man came up to her and the two struck up a conversation. The man introduced himself as Patrick Nicholas. I think he said Pat Nicholas. And he's telling Anne how he was new to the area, so she's still making polite conversation, and she's like, oh, well, this area is big for, like, water sports, you know, do you water ski?
Yeah.
And he responds that he does not, because he can't swim. So, conversation starts out harmless enough. He seemed like an okay dude, but as the conversation progresses, his actions and manner of speaking get stranger and stranger. To the point that Anne's very uncomfortable, and she begins to get up and walk to her car, when he suddenly grabs her and holds a knife to her throat and tells her to get undressed.
God, you cannot trust anybody.
You can't, no. So Anne did as she was told, and this frigging monster took her underwear and shove them in her mouth so she couldn't scream. God. He begins walking her towards the river, and when he stops for a second and he like tells her to stop, she takes this opportunity to run as fast as possible, and she dives into the river. Because remember, he just said he can't swim.
What an idiot.
Yes.
And he uses his real name. That's Bundy, by the way. What is it in Washington? You're like, hi, I'm Ted Bundy.
Exactly.
Nice to meet you. Like, dude, I'm Patrick. So, like, come on.
Come on, guys. I mean, I'm glad you're that dumb, but.
Yeah, I'm glad you're stupid. Yeah, and can't swim.
Anne said she just swam and swam, saying, quote, I swam for my life.
I'm picturing him walking down the, like, she's swimming down the river, like, and he's walking on the shore, like, hey, come on, get out of the water.
Come back. I just want to be friends. Nope. Yeah.
Not doing it.
Nope. And she was later rescued by people on, like, a dock further down the river, and the police were called. He's quickly apprehended and charged with the attempted rape, and he does plead guilty. This part is sick, though. He admits to investigators, quote, I realize that I have a problem concerning raping girls, end quote.
Oh, my God. I don't have
words. Wait, just wait. At his sentencing, with the help of Anne's statements and pleas to the judge to impose a long sentence, Patrick was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
God, why? Sorry, go on.
We're on to justice number two. Do the math here. If Patrick was sentenced to 10 years in 1983 and Sarah was murdered in 1991, he should not have been out.
I don't know how many times this has to happen before people like open their eyes.
Yep.
These people need to be locked away. They're dangerous to society and women especially.
He ended up serving like 3.5 years. Oh, cool. And
good behavior
Which I don't get, because of course that's good behavior. There's no women for you to rape in a man's prison.
Right. Wow.
Well, Anne was never made aware that, like, her almost rapist was barely held accountable and let out. Like, and he was let out and able to hurt another woman, which we know that he did to Sarah on that cold December day in 1991.
When he was arrested, that must have been such a shock to her, because she's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
The guy was in jail.
She didn't even find out about that until, we'll get there. So police realized that Patrick Nicholas had a routine. He would find women in or near their vehicles. He would start a conversation, and then he would pull a knife out and attempt to rape them. And by the way, in 1994, so 3 years after Sarah's murder, he was convicted of assaulting a minor.
Of course he was, because that's what he does.
So, this douchebag filled with dumpster juice has had how many convictions for sexual violence, and yet none of these required him to submit his DNA. Or it did, but he got through this with legal loopholes.
Yeah.
Wow. So, great Way job, guys. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but when authorities searched Patrick's disgusting hellhole of a house, they found a ton of porn featuring young women. Mm-hmm. And there was one that really hit everyone. The girl was dressed like exactly in a cheerleader's uniform. Very similar. Yeah.
Those nudie magazines back in the day, they were essentially categories. You'd be like, I like cheerleader. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
they would pose. It was like a photo shoot, essentially.
Right.
A gross photo shoot.
Very gross. Well, mixed in with all of this, they found like a newspaper that featured Sarah's case.
Oh, get out.
Which is always creepy. So finally, in 2023, over 30 years since Sarah's murder, the murder trial against Patrick Nicholas began. The courtroom was filled with her friends and family. Drew Miller, the 13-year-old who found her, got up on the stand and told his story about the day he found her and just the terrifying run-in that he had with Patrick Nicholas. I will say the prosecutor, a woman named Celia Lee, she went hard on Patrick.
About time somebody did.
Oh, yeah. And I gotta say, Patrick's lawyer, this guy was a goddamn clown. I don't know where he got his law degree, but we could send in these court transcripts and try to get him a refund.
But I mean, how do you defend a scumbag?
No, you're right. But his arguments, his top two were about the genetic genealogy and the composite sketch. So this lawyer first tries to say that Patrick looked nothing like the composite sketch. First of all, he definitely does. And second of all, rarely do I feel like people look like they're sketches. Yeah. Especially when the description comes from 13-year-olds and they vary wildly from person to person.
Totally, totally.
So, dumb argument. And then he decides to convince the jury that this newfangled DNA genealogy was witchcraft. He actually says, quote, "They used technology that was not only unproven, but just wacky, really." End quote.
Just wacky? Are you kidding
me? It's sorcery!
That is wacky stuff.
Yeah. The same technology that solved the Golden State Killer case, the same technology that showed the odds of the killer not being Patrick were literally 1 in 120 quadrillion.
He's probably like, that's not even a real number. Like, now you're just making up numbers. It's like, no, quadrillion's a number.
Do you know how many zeros that is? I looked it up.
It is a wacky amount of zeros.
That's a wacky number of zeros. Yeah. One quadrillion has 15 zeros.
That is too many zeros.
So, one really big bummer in this case, though, the judge decided that none of Patrick's former crimes could be discussed during the trial. Which, I get it, but I think it's bullshit. We'll get back to it. But ultimately, it really didn't matter. The jury deliberated for about a day, and then on Thursday, May 25th, 2023, they delivered the following verdict. Patrick Nicholas was found not guilty of the first charge, first-degree murder.
How on earth is he not guilty? Oh, my God.
I just wanted to set you up. This is great. He was found guilty of first-degree murder and second-degree murder, not premeditated.
That's messed up. You're like, he was not guilty of littering, but he was. I'm like,
can you imagine, though, how her family must have felt hearing that first not guilty?
First of all, you're waiting 30 years for closure. Second of all, the writing is on the wall. This guy did it.
So yes.
To hear that, man, wow. Just wow.
I mean, like, it was like they got punched in the gut. But yeah, again,
you better hang in on those next words. Like, the next word better be guilty because.
Yes. So he was found guilty of first degree murder and second degree murder. And the jury also ruled that these crimes had been committed with sexual motivation.
He should be going away for a long, long time.
A long time.
Finally.
So the next step was sentencing. And this was probably one of the roughest parts of this case. Sarah's friends and loved ones got up one by one and explained to the judge, the jury, the courtroom, and of course the monster himself, what had been taken from them when Sarah was murdered, and more importantly, what was taken from her life.
He doesn't care, though.
No, but I will say there is a point where he was shook. So hold on. Sarah's mom stood up and talked about how Sarah's death left their family broken and they never recovered. Her youngest brother, who was 11 when his sister was murdered, stood up and talked about seeing his parents so destroyed and hearing the pain and despair in their voices. Like, he could hear them crying through the walls at night. Drew Miller, the 13-year-old boy who found her body, stood up. And talked about that experience forever impacted him.
How brave, though, that these kids who were young at the time got up. Even, I know it was a lot later, but how brave.
Well, and one of Sarah's friends stood up and said, quote, "He took her life and what was sure to be a brilliant future from her. In taking Sarah, he took the innocence of every one of us," end quote.
Including everybody in that little town.
Exactly.
It's Delphi 2.0.
It is. And then, in a scene that could be out of a movie, one more person goes up to the podium. Anne Crony, the young woman who Patrick had attempted to rape way back in June of 83. This is when the shitbag looks up, sees her, realizes who she is. He looks like he saw a ghost.
Good, good.
There's clips of it. It's wonderful.
I can't wait to see them.
So Anne stood up there and told everyone what he did to her. She told everyone how he should have been in jail when Sarah was killed. And she pleaded with the judge and the jury to lock this monster up forever by saying, quote, We rely on a system of justice that is designed to protect us from predators like Nicholas. And this system failed me. It failed Sarah, her family, friends, and countless others. I ask the court to please not make the same mistake, end quote.
Let's hope that they do finally learn a lesson.
And then it was time for the judge to speak, and you know I love me a sassy judge.
They're the best.
Judge Josephine Wiggs did not disappoint. She went off, like banging her fists on the table and saying, good, quote, when I think about this poor child, and what she experienced fighting for her life. She also said, quote, this outrageous sexual assault upon a child culminating in her murder is a basis for an exceptional sentence, end quote. She kept saying child, and like,
that's what she was.
Yes. And all of this changed her lives. So finally, it was time to deliver Patrick Nicholas's punishment. He was sentenced to 45 years and 8 months in prison. And at the age of 59, when he was sentenced, this monster will most likely die a lonely and miserable death in a dark, cold cell. Which is still better than he deserves, but...
Yeah, and I hope every day the image of Anne on the stand bothers him, because you know Sarah was just another name and another face to him. So I hope seeing that woman, he realized, he was like, oh shit, like maybe that little bit of anxiety that he felt when she got up on the stand, magnify that by 1,000, and that's what your victims felt, dude. So you are exactly where you belong.
Exactly. So this is where the case like should have ended, but there's actually been an update since I started researching. So it is the end of May 2025 when we're recording this. Just a few weeks ago, on May 5th, 2025, the douche filed an appeal, basically saying, it's not fair you took my cigarette butt, even though, you know, I threw it out because I'm trashy.
That's all you need to know. That's read between the lines.
That's official court lingo translator right here. I got you.
Crazy.
I feel like it's karma. You're trash and your trash got you.
An awesome way to look at it. Pretty symbolic.
So he's basically essentially trying to say that the DNA is not good enough.
Right.
He's... wants a Fry hearing, which is a pretrial legal proceeding that determines the admissibility of scientific evidence.
Right.
So basically, our idiot murderer is questioning the methods that the goddess Colleen Fitzpatrick like used. And here's my take on that. Like, everyone's entitled to an appeal, but DNA, you're going to question DNA.
Because what else are they going to do? They're grasping at any straw in the legal system that can help them get out of jail.
Exactly. So we will see where this appeal goes. Like, it's so new that it just happened. I can't imagine it's going to go very far.
I don't think so.
Yeah, he's where he belongs. But
yep.
That is the brutal and heartbreaking case of the murder of 16-year-old Sarah Yarborough.
There's no lesson here either, because she wasn't doing anything wrong. I mean, and it sucks, because think about all of the things that had to come together for this to happen. Like, if she sets her alarm for the right time, this doesn't happen. So like, just that little moment in time caused this whole mess. 30 years of pain and suffering. And 30 years is just the legal portion of it. Like, this family, this is forever now. She's not there for any holidays, any birthdays, anything that goes on in that family's life. She's gone for it. It's all because of some dumb little mistake.
That was a tough one to get through. We hope, you know, everyone enjoyed it. If you can enjoy something like this, you know what I mean?
Yeah, enjoy in the sense of an interesting story. And some, obviously, these all have good positive endings because they catch the guy. But yeah, that was really sad. But a great way to kick off this blog. It shows you kind of an example of the way cold cases can affect families, and a heartbreaking one, because I come from a small town and I know how something like this would affect them. And going to Delphi, I saw how small towns deal with this stuff, and it does. It changes them forever.
It's wild. Well, I would like to know what our listeners think about this case.
Me too.
I will also say, I looked for like petitions to your legislature to try to make states be okay with familial, but I couldn't. So I'm going to keep looking. I don't know that I was Googling the right things. So we will definitely post that if we can find anything. And that could be found on our socials, Facebook, TikTok, Insta, a bunch of others at Murder Unscripted. You can email us your thoughts on this case, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can actually send us a little message through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Pay $4 a month for that service, so send us an email.
Yeah, like, come on, we're paying for nothing. Don't ever write to us.
Make JotForm worth it, will you? Jeez.
Well, that's all we have today. So until next time, remember to be safe. Hug your loved ones and your friends. Tell them that they matter. And of course, remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They do have pepperoni nips, though.
And wear trench coats. Sometimes. And wear trench coats. Yeah. Bye.